In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and I've got another coolest conversations for you, presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be speaking with Exene Cervenka, lead singer of the seminal Los Angeles band X. They've been active since 1977. Their ninth album, Smoke and Fiction, comes out in August. And next year, they'll be one of the headlining acts on the inaugural Little Steven's Underground Garage cruise, going from Miami to Nassau, May the 9th through the 13th. X's latest single is Big Black X. We'll hear some of it now, followed by my talk with Exene on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Manfred here, and I hope you're ready for our coolest conversations, because on the line with me now is singer, artist, and poet Exene Cervenka, best known as the lead singer of the long-running LA band X. How are you, Exene?
I am fantastic. Thank you for asking. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well and very happy to be chatting with you. So, what's interesting to me here, X identified with being Los Angeles, but I found online where it said you were actually born in Chicago. Now, is that true? You're from Illinois?
Yes, that's
Illinois?
True.
When did you come?
Illinois. I didn't grow up here. I grew up in Illinois, very rural. I was born in 1956. I lived in the middle of nowhere in farm country, and I lived there until I was 13. Then we moved to Florida, and that was insanely great. And then I moved to Los Angeles, which was insanely great. So I'm very fortunate.
Oh, so you said you went to Florida when you were 13?
Yeah, I think it was 13.
About
yeah.
13. So how old were you when you came out to L.A.?
20,
okay. So all the schooling and sort of stuff, that happened between Illinois and Florida.
Well, if you want to call, I went to Catholic school in Illinois, so that was incredible. You know, the education I got, the reading and writing and arithmetic. Yeah. But I dropped out of high school on my 16th birthday in Florida because there was just no reason to go.
Oh, why do you say that?
Well, there was race wars. It was Florida. The education system was terrible. I mean, it's not as bad as California is now, but it was bad at the time. I wasn't learning anything. It was the hippies hated me. There wasn't punk yet. The normal kids hated me. The black kids hated me. I was a weirdo and a freak because it was before punk, but I still wore vintage clothes and weird stuff and red lipstick, and everyone just avoided me, and the teachers didn't like me, and I was always in trouble just for being me, and I wanted to get a job and an apartment, so when I was 16, that's what I did.
And so, let me ask you, I know that you had an older sister that passed away in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any other brothers or sisters?
I had two younger sisters. Well, I have an older sister, but I didn't know that then. But yeah.
Okay. And you still keep in contact with any of their siblings?
Oh, my sisters and I are all great friends. Yeah, we see each other as much as possible. We're scattered all over the country, from New York to Minnesota to California to Arizona, but we get together at least once a year, twice a year usually.
So you dropped out when you were 16 there in Florida. What got you to L.A.?
Okay. So I was living in Tallahassee. It was kind of like, I didn't have anywhere else to go. I was living with a friend in Tallahassee, and I had a Cadillac, a 1950 Cadillac, and some cool old stuff, but I couldn't find a job, and couldn't pay my rent. And so I got a phone call from somebody who was moving to California, and they asked me if I would go with them so that I could pay for gas. And I knew Paul Rubens, and I knew Fay Hart, and they both lived in the LA area. And so I called them. And Paul said, oh, don't come to Hollywood. It's terrible. It's really seedy and sleazy, and you're too nice. You're too pure and nice of a person. And because he was friends with my sister mostly. Uh-huh. He was trying to look out for me. And Faye said, sure, come to California. You can live with me. So I got in a car with a little tweed suitcase and a paper bag and $150, I think. And got to Santa Monica without even knowing anything about California, hardly. And except, you know, the Beach Boys and Rock and Roll on the Doors and the Hollywood sign. And I got a job.
What was the job?
The job was working at the largest small press library in the world, poetry workshop, famous place, which I'd never heard of, called Beyond Baroque. Started in the 60s by a really cool kind of gay, beat, hippie, intelligent, crazy, interesting guy. And I got a job there doing typesetting and layout, which is the precursor, of course, to computers. Working in this library where I could read poetry books all day and being around all these poets and going to poetry workshops. And so I decided I'll go to the poetry workshop after a couple of weeks. And lo and behold, John Doe came in and sat next to me. And it was his first time at the workshop and my first time at the workshop. And then, of course, we hung out after, and he told me that there was music in Los Angeles. I'd heard of the Ramones and Patti Smith, but I didn't really know much past that. And he said, there's this place called The Mask, and they have bands. And he had a car, and he lived in Venice, and I lived in Venice. And he said, let's go see these bands. We went and saw The Screamer tear up. The Screamers were amazing, of course. And we went and started going to shows and stuff and talking about doing music. And eventually we did, you know.
So you mentioned having heard of the Ramones, Patti Smith. So obviously you had a thing about writing and poetry. But was how did music fit into that? I mean, when you were like in your teens and stuff, I mean, was there much music in the home? Or were,
no, there wasn't much music in the home.
Yeah.
We had a hi-fi, and we had like three records. We had a Ray Charles record. We had a Dinah Washington record. And I don't even know if we had a third record. We didn't have books. We had some Reader's Digest condensed. It was just not a very literary, like I had a Grimm's Fairy Tale that I got for Christmas one year. But then my parents, when I was 12, I got the Bobby Gentry, Glen Campbell record, which is so great. And the Doors record on the same Christmas. What? And we had Mr. Man, we had AM/FM radio. And we had the Chicago radio stations. So we had all of the great AM radio. And then when FM radio started, can you imagine being 12 and getting that in your on your transistor radio? That was mind expanding, mind blowing. And then, of course, my sister would have had a record player, and she would say, oh, I want you to hear this record. So she'd play me Tim Buckley or Laura Nyro or Janis Joplin. And I would just be standing there staring at the record going around. And then I remember the first time I heard Bob Dylan, I think I was in third grade, and that was just like mind blowing. You know, the whole thing was just, I mean, it's not like now, you know.
How do you mean not like now?
Well, I mean, if you're a kid now, it's like you're not going to suddenly wander into a magical situation where you're just walk home from school, put down your little school books, turn on the radio, and all of a sudden you hear like a Rolling Stone. That's just going to blow your Yeah, I mean, that's going to, your whole reality is going to change in an instant. Your mind is going to expand and you're just going to like be turned inside out. Whereas now it's like you're just going to get brainwashed by some corporate entities. And so, and you're going to get it 24 hours a day, whether you want it or not. So, and then you know what? And then you play Bob Dylan and then you get out of your school uniform and you go out and play until dinner time. I don't know. It was just, I mean, I hate to do that because I've been doing that my whole life. No, you don't understand. Life used to be great. And it still is for a lot of people's kids. I know a lot of young people that have like great exposure to amazing things, and they're not completely like just left to their own devices for the corporate brainwashing thing to kick in. It depends on who you are too. I mean, I'm sure there were other kids my age who had a completely different experience, but I was in the middle of nowhere, and that's what I learned. It was amazing.
Well, you may, what's interesting to me here too is, I mean, you were a literary person, you were a poet, and but you said family-wise that wasn't really going on. So what got you, and there you're with John Doe at the poetry workshop. Well, when did you start writing? Did you consider
When
yourself
I
a
started
poet?
writing when I was about 12, and my sister gave me, they have these books you used to be able to buy all the time that are like journals, but they're like ledgers. And so they're from the 20s and 30s, and they usually have a green cover and they're long and thin, and they say accounting or journal or something like that on them. And then they have these like lined things with columns. She gave me a small one of those, and it was blank. And I remember I was probably about 12, and I said, "Well, what am I supposed to do with this?" And she went, "Right, you're supposed to write in it." And so, my sister, being this divine being from heaven, I decided, "Oh," and I immediately started writing in it. I still have it. And she taught me a lot of stuff. She would take me on the train to Chicago, and we'd go to cool places like the museums and stuff. She was kind of a odd person. She was like not really of this world. I can't really describe it.
What is her
But
name? Is it
everybody
Mir?
that knew her would say that.
This is
Anyway,
Miriam. What is
she
her
just,
name? Mary, was it Miriam?
Muriel. It was
Miriam.
Mary at the time. But she kind of guided me along. And then, whatever she said, I did. And it was like, and then it would just open up this whole other world, and
How much older how much older was
about
she
a year and
than
a half.
a year and a half? Okay.
So when I wrote, I was writing a lot and living in this little apartment. And the only thing in the apartment in Venice that I had was I moved in and I had my clothes. There was a table and two chairs in the kitchen, and it was one of those old chrome tables. And then somehow I got a mattress on the floor. I don't know if it came there or I got it somewhere. Someone gave it to me. And there was an old giant TV in there that just got one channel, and it was Dr. Eugene Scott. And if you know who that is, you couldn't have asked for a better one channel, 24 hours a day of the most insane televangelist you've ever, performance art you've ever seen. That was literally it. I had no other furniture. And then downstairs from me was that poetry workshop. I lived upstairs from the poetry workshop and where I worked, and I would take the radio, the clock radio, AM, FM radio out of there after everyone left, and I'd put it in my apartment. And I'd listen to Wolfman Jack, Dedications, and I'd drink cheap wine or whatever I could scrape together to get, because there was also a liquor store downstairs, and I was a blooming alcoholic, and I would write. And then I would get up in the morning and I would put the radio back and go to work and work all day, and then either go out to see a show with John or something, or just write and or wander around and get in trouble, hit the women's gay bar and get free drinks, and then hitchhiked somewhere with some people I didn't know to get something else. And it was just crazy. I was just crazy then. But I was writing, and I wrote a song. I wrote a song called I'm Coming Over, and I sang it to John because I didn't know how to play music. And he said he wanted to do it. He had met Billy and he wanted to do it in his band. And I was like, no way, you can't take my song. And he said, okay, but you're a really good writer and I want to do your stuff. And I go, no, you can't have it. It's all I have in the world. It's this one thing of value. And he said, okay, you have to come and sing it with us. And of course, I'd never sung a song in my life. I went over there and met Billy and hung out. We started doing stuff together, and I was not good.
You're saying that you're not good. But first,
So he's got Billy there, and what and Mr. Bone Break there, DJ Bone Break. So
He came much later,
he
yeah.
came later. Okay. And so you're feeling self-conscious, you're singing, but I mean that you got you must have John must have been pretty supportive. I mean Billy too to, for you to keep going.
They were, but it was the punk rock thing when anything could happen. If it had been now, or it'd been a different scene, like the scene like maybe that really great singers like Pat Benatar, or Heart, those kinds of people, or even Missing Persons or Berlin, they had to be, real singers. They were really, really amazing singers and are. And in the punk scene, you just had to have the right amount of weirdness. You didn't have to look a certain way, you didn't have to sound a certain way, you didn't have to be a certain way. It was just free expression. I mean, punk rock really was performance art, if you look at it. Now, the fact that I was in a band with three of the greatest musicians in Los Angeles put it a little bit past performance art. So they were just like, whatever, let's just try it. And John and I practiced night and day. We rehearsed. I hated him so much. We would sit in his apartment in Venice, and they were about to redo his building because they're about to gentrify. Venice and Santa Monica were total. It was dog town. It was black ghetto. It was poor people. It was beatniks and hippies. It was the poorest place you could live. And now it's the most affluent, right? But so he was the last apartment in his building. He was the last tenant left in his three-story apartment building as they were going to remodel it and renovate it and tear it down. He just refused to move. It was right at the Santa Monica Pier, and it was right on the ocean, and it was just amazing. Anyway, we would sit in there, and we would practice, and he would play the bass or the. I think he had the acoustic guitar then too. He would play me records. He had a record player again, someone with a record player, and he would play me. We'd play Little Richard and Carl Perkins and Mose Allison. He was like, "Have you ever heard this?" I was like, "No, what is it?" And he played me the whole Mose Allison record. It's like. So, he was East Coast. He was smart. He knew things. I didn't know nothing. So, and then we would do these songs. Like I'll never forget, like some of the songs he wrote before he met me, and then after we wrote songs together, we would just he would play. We would play it over and over again. We would do the chorus over and over, just a loop of the chorus with me singing. And I would get so angry and frustrated. I can't do it. I don't know how to do it. I don't want to do it. He'd be like, "Exceed. You can do it. You've almost got it. Come on, let's keep going." And he wasn't telling me what to sing. Sometimes he guided me, for sure. And I would say, "Stop telling me what to sing." And he'd go, "Okay, then sing whatever you want." But he was just trying to get me to learn how to sing on key or learn how to sing with someone or learn how to do anything, as I didn't want to do anything. I just wanted to drink and go see bands and have fun and run around and be bad, so. Because I was like that.
There's this thing too where you mentioned I guess in these teen years of always being nobody really getting what you were about and the whatever different cliques not kind of looking at you as an outsider and then you mentioned punk rock as a performance thing didn't matter what you are is what when the bands first started you must have come out on your own then right I mean that must have been must have felt pretty good about being accepted as yourself or not what
Were
was
we?
Well, within
I
that
mean, don't
community,
forget that,
finding
we were still.
finding a community of like-minded people and being
Oh,
able to,
that part, yes, that within the group, within the context, with not without like media. It was amazing. And we were fearless, and that has to be said because we had no idea. It was like when you saw this, when I saw the Screamers, I could not believe it. When I saw Tomato Diplenty and Tommy Garrett and KK, I could not believe what they were doing. So as soon as they're done, or John, you have to too remember, John has no fear. Like John will just go up to anybody and do anything. John will just brazenly bluff his way into a club. John will just tell somebody a bunch of bullshit, and then. And then become friends with them. But just anything to get that foot in the door of something cool. You know what I mean? Like he was like, bluff our way into this. You know, he would go up to the guy, you know, he'd go up to Mario who ran, you know, the whiskey. And he would just, we'd walk up the street and there'd be a band in there. It was like, maybe like Tom Petty and Blondie, you know?
Yeah.
And we didn't have any money. He would just walk up there and go, blah, 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 blah. And he would just talk to him man to man. And then he would say, and then we would get in. And I'd go, how did you do that? He'd go, I just told him you were my girlfriend. And, you know, we were on our first date and I really wanted to impress you. And I was trying to be cool and I didn't have any money. And, you know, whatever it took. And then there we were, you know, or the star, you know, and he was just really good at that. Anyway, I don't know why I'm going on about John's. Oh, and so.
Well, because you guys are, you know, he's pretty important to the story of the band, to the story of you being able to, you know, become, develop as an artist,
yes.
You know.
That's... Because I am terminally shy. Mm. I won't still to this day go into somebody's dressing room when I'm on the guest list. I'm like, no, 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 we don't want to buy. Like, well, let's just go say, no, no. And I would drink until I could talk, you know, and
yeah.
I was terrified of everything because I'd never been in a city. You know, I lived in St. Pete briefly and I loved it, but it wasn't like LA. And anyway, so, but when we would go to the Mask or someplace like that, you could just walk, you know, I was 20 and you could just talk to these other kids. And then I turned 21 and then I could get into these clubs. Before wow. I was 21, I couldn't go to the Whiskey or the Starwood or stuff like that. I could go to the Roxy, but anyway, so it was just, it was just by degrees and then meeting all these people. Cause like when you're walking down Hollywood Boulevard, if you saw somebody that wasn't wearing bell bottoms, you immediately zeroed in on each other and started talking. Excuse me, because you knew you were the same.
Right.
I mean, like meeting Black Randy and people like that was just insane. And then they're meeting Billy was crazy because that was like meeting Jerry Lee Lewis. I mean, the way he looked and the way he dressed and how cool he was just, I mean, he was a god, you know. And so there was every type of person. You know, there was young girls younger than me. There was like the Germs. There was all these crazy people. Nobody was the same. Nobody looked the same. Nobody acted the same. There were kids that went to Hollywood High. There were dropouts like me. There were kids from broken homes who grew up doing drugs from the third grade because their parents just weren't there.
Yeah.
And then there were like really smart, like East Coast intelligentsia. And there was like Claude Bessie. Like there were French people. There were old people. There were movie people. There was, you know, the craziest group of people you can imagine.
Okay, so... The band starts and you were, you know, been rehearsing with John.
John and Billy, and we're looking for a drummer. Yeah.
Right. And you bring on the DJ and my gosh, you've had this incredible ride. So, and now we're looking at this ninth studio album coming out summer, August the 2nd. Smoking Fiction, and it's, you know, billed as being the last album, and
yes.
We took a listen to the singles out now, Big Black X, and I want to ask you about that song, drill down on that song, but first, well, why is this the final album? What's
okay? Well, here's the thing. I think, you know, we just played a couple shows this week. We're still really good live. We are older. I'm the youngest. I'm 68 and a half. Billy's had cancer twice. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. It's hard to do things. It's hard, but we're a punk rock band. And I will say it is our last studio album and we are winding down the touring. We have tours. We are touring till the end of the year. Then we have the little Stevie cruise next year, which I'm so happy about.
Right. Well,
we're
going to talk about that too. Yeah.
Yes. And people say, oh no, this isn't your last tour, but they don't understand what touring means to us. It's just playing endless amounts of shows. We don't like, we're not Taylor Swift. It's not like we're doing this tour. It's named this and we're playing 800 times and this is going to be, we're going to make $80 billion. It's like, no, we just play shows. So when you say it's our last tour, it just means if our booking agent can add more shows to the end, if we can play Philadelphia, New York and Charlotte, well, then we'll add Charlotte, you know? We make a living touring. This is how we pay. Well, how I pay my rent is touring, among other things. And so we want to keep playing as long as we can. But one day, you know, we tour in vans. We stay in like the Best Western. We're not rich and we don't travel in luxury because you know what? We're like the Ramones. We want to make our money at the end of the day. You give it to a bus driver and fancy hotels, you come home, you got no money. So that's why it's hard. Okay, it's hard. It's physically, the van thing is physically difficult and hard, and it's not easy. But we are a punk rock band, so 2 years from now we might go, hey, screw this, let's make another record. But I don't want to say that because I don't think
Right.
it's going to happen, and I don't want people to go, then why did you say it's your last record? I guess what I'm saying is, who knows what the future brings, but I can guarantee you we're planning on this being our last record, and that the tour thing is going to wind down. And at some point, one of us is going to say we can't do it anymore. I want to give people fair warning. My son never got to see the Ramones, and that breaks my heart because that was the one re that's probably the only regret I have besides having to get divorced is that my son didn't get to see the Ramones, and that's on me. But they were always playing these places he couldn't go to, like the
Yeah.
Palladium, which, and he was a kid, when they stopped. But I want people to be able to say they got to see us, and that their kids got to see us, and their grandparents got to see us with their grandkids. Because I see that sometimes, three generations in the front row. I mean, it's on them, but we have a really great fan base. Like, we've had the same fans since we started, some of them,
Yeah.
and we have a smart fan base, and we have an interesting, cool bunch of people that love us, and they're not in legion amounts, but they are there, and I want them to know that they can come see us again and again, and then it'll be over because I don't want them to miss it. Come
Yeah.
now or forever hold your pieces.
Well, about Smoke and Fiction. So, for now, we'll say final album.
Yes, it is.
When and where did it get recorded?
Oh, it got recorded at the amazing Sunset Sound.
Okay.
Sunset Sound, that is a, look it up. It's historic. It's, everybody's recorded there, and it's like an amazing place in music and LA history. And then we recorded all the basics there and some of the bass, I think, and stuff like that, and guitar. And then we did the rest at Rob Schnapf's studio, and Rob is the best, and he's pretty well known as a great producer. And he's got a really cool little space that's really funky and cool and amazing art and stuff. He's just great. And we recorded it there, all the vocals and everything. And that's where we also recorded Alphabet Land, our last record.
Right. Well, so I know Rob worked on that one as well. How did you guys wind up connecting with him? How did he wind up working with you on Alphabet Land and
He's a cool guy, and I think he knew Billy.
Okay.
I don't know if it's because I'm not on social media or Facebook, and I don't understand any of it. But I think people meet that way. I'm not sure. And I think he knows our manager too. But anyway, he's pretty amazing, and just happened. I really don't know.
Well, thinking about the single Big Black X, the lyrics, like a lot of y'all's songs read as poetry, and the phrases seem to pertain to different memories. I'm assuming these are all over the course of the band's lifetime.
Well, John and I write the lyrics, and certain ones I wrote, and certain ones he wrote, and certain ones we wrote together. But our songs are always like that. They're about real experiences, like your phone's off the hook in Los Angeles. And they're sometimes think, well, first of all, as soon as you write something down, it already happened. It's in the past. So nostalgia doesn't exist. She had to leave Los Angeles. It already happened. It's a long time ago. It could have been yesterday, but it's over. They're just, it's the same way we always write. We've written so many songs, both as individuals and as partners and as ex. I mean, I've written or co-written over 100 songs, so they can't all be about the same stuff. It's hard.
Right. Well, I was wondering in Big Black X, are any of these phrases are they I mean I know they're memories from the band, but are any of them like a specific thing to your experience
They
yourself?
all are.
Yeah. Like which
They all are.
ones?
It's about what things that we did
Like
and
did
things
you
that we
like Errol
remember.
Flynn's Abandoned Mansion? Did you ever go to the Abandoned Mansion yourself? Was that
Of
something the
course. So
band
why would
did?
we put it
Yeah.
in the song?
Well, what I'm trying to find out is, which phrase directly relates to a specific memory, maybe that's only of your own.
All of them.
All of them. Okay.
None of it's fiction.
Who's the Vietnam vet that you met and cannot forget?
Well, he's a Vietnam vet I met. There was this guy who, when I lived in Venice, the boardwalk was still empty of people, and I could walk down the Venice boardwalk when it was foggy, when it was just starting to get dark, and be the only person on it. And I had like these really great experiences. There was a sidewalk cafe that had a jukebox, and I used to go walk down to the sidewalk cafe, and I didn't have any money, so I would just stand in the doorway and listen to the jukebox play for entertainment. And then one day I was walking, and there was a car at the intersection, and I mean there were no cars down there, Windward and Pacific, and this guy pulled up, and he looked just like Montgomery Clift. I'm serious. And he said, "Hey, you want to ride?" And I just was like, "Yes." So I got in, and we drove around, and I realized that he wasn't all there. While we were driving around, he was looking at every woman he saw and trying to get them to get in the car too, which did not bother me because they weren't dumb enough to get in the car. I was. We ended up hanging out in Venice. He lived near me, and it was a pretty scary situation. I don't want to break his anonymous anonymity. But man, was that a hell ride. And I was mad for this guy. I just thought he was the coolest, scariest person I'd ever met. But I was also seeing John at the time, and John was, there was a thing where I was like, either get with John or die, which are you gonna do? So maybe that's an exaggeration, but I don't know. Anyway, so I never forgot this guy. And then I met another Vietnam vet, because you know, it was 76. These guys were just getting back from the war. They were seriously screwed up, and they had been through hell. And then there was another a guy I met who was much sweeter and cooler, and I got, you know, more friendly involved with him to some extent. And he would just enact these scenes from Vietnam in my living room, because I had that just big empty living room with no furniture, and he would just enact his battlefield dramas. And it was just break. It was like stunningly heartbreaking and interesting. And so I'll never forget those guys. You know, I mean, they may be gone. They were older than me. They may be gone. They may still be out there somewhere. I don't know.
You know, you played the Troubadour here in LA. This is very recent. And you were presented at the show. This is what I read anyway, a proclamation from the city of West Hollywood. What did the proclamation say?
Whatever Dwight said.
Pardon?
Were you there?
No, I wasn't there. I didn't even know you guys
Okay,
were
so
playing.
Dwight Yoakam, we asked Dwight to present it to us.
Okay.
And he read the whole thing. And I was like, "Dwight, don't read the whole thing. It's too long." He goes, "No, I'm going to read the whole thing. I'm going to read it. I'm going to read it." And it was just like, whereas X was like cool, and whereas X was important, and whereas X lived here, and whereas X is blah, 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 X. You know, we got one from Los Angeles too, a long time ago. And it's this amazing, weird kind of thing you never think would happen, which is legitimacy and respect. I think what happened was when John and I lived on Genesee, which is the house where Billy lived and a couple of runaways lived and Top Jimmy lived, and we were in the decline Western civilization. That was the little bungalow, that duplex we lived in, like five people in a one, you know, one bedroom, tiny place. Anyway. They widened our street because it was like 1980, and they were starting to like destroy Hollywood by putting in apartment buildings and packing in. It was like the wave of immigration was coming, and there wasn't enough places to live, so they just started tearing it apart. And they had to widen the streets to put more traffic on Genesee. And it was just so when they widened the street, they had to put in a new sidewalk. So John and I wrote our names on the curb with a stick, you know, carved in, and it's still there. So somebody decided to bring it to the attention, I think, of the government of West Hollywood, which is of course a gay city mostly, and said, "Hey, this is neat. Look, John and Maxine." And I don't know if they made that like a protected landmark, that curb, or not. I don't know what. Don't ask me. I just know that suddenly we're okay. And I think that's what led them to making the proclamation. I don't think it came from us. It wasn't like we went to West Hollywood and said, "We're really important. Give us a thing."
But it's nice to get a thing or not. It's nice to get a thing.
It's fantastic to get a thing
Yeah.
and to do
Yeah.
it in front of our fans with Dwight presenting it.
Yeah.
It was super, man. It was just, it was, I was thrilled. I was happy. I was a kid.
Good. Good. All right. So we talked about, this tour is coming up. The album again comes out August the 2nd. And you're touring after that. And then next year, you're going to be part of the inaugural Little Stevens Underground Garage Cruise, the very first one, and it's sailing, let's see, the May the 9th to the 13th from Miami to Nassau. Have you, well, first of all, have you ever been on a cruise before?
We did two. I've only been as a band. We
Okay.
did Flogging Molly, which just I was amazed. That was the best experience. We got on Flogging Molly's tour a couple years ago because the distillers had to cancel at the last minute, so they just grabbed us. So this the tour had been sold out, right? It was at
Yeah.
the end of COVID, so it was the first time any like shows were happening. And I didn't know any. I know Flogging Molly, the great band, and really wonderful people. Didn't know a lot of the other bands. No one bought a ticket to CX because it was sold out before we were even announced.
Right.
So the people on the show, on the ship, weren't there to see us, and they weren't particularly X fans. They were Flogging Molly fans. But I witnessed something so amazing on that tour. It was the first time that those people had gotten together because the COVID had interrupted their wonderful group of, they're like deadheads kind of, but they're
Yeah.
Flogging Molly.
Yeah.
I saw people hugging each other and crying and being so excited to be on that cruise. I saw so much love and affection, and I got swept up into it and met all the people. I hung out the whole time with all these people, and I felt like, wow, what a great family. I really was moved. It was a, I made friends. It was a fantastic experience, and it had nothing to do with being on a cruise. It had to do with being part of this thing. So when we got to do the next one, which is Outlaw Country out of LA, I
Yeah.
was just raring to go, and I had the best time in that. I got to see Lucinda Williams and Deke Dickerson all day and all night, and I got to hang out with people. And I'm very social now. I didn't used to be. I was shy, right? But
Right.
I really love to hang out with people, and I don't feel like, oh, I'm in a band. I got to hang out. It's just like I'm a fan of Deke Dickerson too. I want to go see him.
Well, right,
So I'm
myself as
super
well. So
excited about.
this is Deke playing as the Untamed Youth, and maybe he's going to do his own thing as well. But have you ever seen him play as the Untamed Youth as a garage rock band before?
I have not.
Well, you will.
I'm super excited. And you know, when I say we say it's our last tour, but we're talking a year, almost a year from now.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, I'm so excited I bought tickets. I can't wait to see you guys play. And I'm like, okay, I hope we make it. You know, because I don't know if we'll make it. But here's the thing. I'm going on that tour no matter on that cruise ship, no matter what. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to read. So, are you familiar with who else is on the cruise? I mean, you mentioned
Let's
Deke
read it
Dickerson.
out loud to the
Yeah, I'm going to read it
people.
out loud. Okay, here we go. So, Social Distortion, yourselves, Rocket from the
Yay.
Crypt, Reverend Horton Heat, Old 97s, Low Cut Connie, Lost Straitjackets, Lenny K, Flaming Groovies, the Dictators, the Chesterfield Kings, the Fleshtones, Super Suckers, Linda Gail Lewis. Slim Jim Phantom Trio, the Dolly Rots, my band, the Woggles, the Coolies, Untamed Youth, Dick Dickerson, Neanderthals, the Sound Minds, the Goons. It's also going to be Mark Lindsay, from Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Oh, kill me.
No, I'm not going to kill you. I want you to be on the cruise.
No, I, oh my God.
and I know the Cocktail Slippers or another, the couple of others that have been added. I feel bad if I'm leaving anybody out, but. But that's all. Those are all the acts. Also, myself and some of the other underground garage disc jockeys will be emceeing on there. Michael DeBar and Palmyra Doran, Peters Rembert from the Fleshtones, Kelly Ogden from the Dolly Rots will all be on there too. And no, Lenny K is also a DJ in the underground garage. Did you know that? If you know that.
Yeah.
But he's going to do his Nuggets celebration thing where he plays, tracks from the Nuggets album. I'm not sure what the band is that's going to back him on there, but anyway, so lots of time, lots of acts to check out while you're cruising, right?
But that is a great, amazing lineup, and that is going to be so fun. I can't even believe it that that's happening.
Well, hey,
And I can't
go
believe
ahead.
it's the first one. I mean, that's such a great
Yes, this is the
concept, you
first
know.
one. Was, you're a veteran from the Outlaw Country Cruises. So, and that is another channel that little Steven oversees. He has that, and he has the Underground Garage, and the late Jeremy Tepper, of course, did all the hands-on stuff with the Outlaw Country channel. And so he's sad that he passed
Yeah,
unexpectedly.
I know that is
But
so sad. See this, this world. Okay.
But this so this has been a long time coming, and then when they finally were getting it together, that's when we were coming out of COVID. Then there was a second wave, and then the war in Ukraine started. And that original cruise was going to sail in the Aegean, like from out of Athens to Turkey and
Oh,
back
good
again.
idea. Yeah, okay.
But then it fell apart because of the war and COVID. And so that this one ends up being the first one, and you will be sailing. We'll be sailing together.
Man, I am gonna be so happy to be on that boat. I'll probably be the happiest of all. But anyway, yeah, that's great. I hope people I wish it could be a bigger boat for more people. But
Well, these
anyway,
boats are
we'll,
big, aren't they?
I
As I
guess
mean,
they're
I don't
big. I don't
know.
know. I
I've
hear
never
this
been on
one's
a
bigger than
cruise.
the one I
I've
wasn't
never been
on
on a
the
cruise. You'll have to take me under your wing and show me what do you do on the cruise. I
Okay,
mean,
well, the
it's a
first thing
plan. I
is,
know that. What's
let me
that?
give you some tips. Don't wear
Okay.
cowboy boots.
Don't wear what?
Cowboy boots, because I just was wearing my cowboy boots, and it's kind of slick sometimes with water, and it
Oh.
moves, and the it's kind of hard. You got to get a grip. That's why they call those things deck shoes that look like Vans.
Oh, yeah, like
That's what you
that.
got to wear, like suction cup bottoms. And you will be prepared to walk and walk and walk and walk and walk, because when you have to walk all that length of the boat back and forth and back and forth and up and down the stairs and back and forth and back and forth. And so you get a lot of walk, which I
Well, great.
love.
I'm going to get all the exercise I need.
Yes, you are.
Well, did you ever get seasick?
No.
Now, when you were on the boat, did you felt like you were on a boat, or did you only feel like you were on a boat if you were like standing outside holding on to a railing or something?
It's not like, when you take ferries in
Yeah.
Europe,
Yeah.
it's not like that.
Oh, okay.
You're not going
Well,
from side to side, but you can feel it when you're walking down the long, long hallway.
yeah.
You can feel you're on a boat, but you're not like weaving back and forth. It's pretty stable. Those big boats are pretty solid, but I guess it can get rough at times. And sometimes you have to can't. Sometimes when you're playing outside, they have to move the show inside.
Oh,
Because
okay.
the wind.
Well, so tell me about that. So I know there are like multiple stages, and is and the artist plays several times over the course of the trip. Does that mean I mean, you're gonna have to make a decision throughout the day of who you're gonna see at what time, right?
Well, yeah, but that's why they have people play more than once. But I got to say, there's one thing that those cruises do that's amazing. It's the sixth man.
Yeah.
The crew is called the sixth man, and they are the best crew you will ever see in your life. Sometimes I just watch them instead of the show, because you got all these really, really strong and heavy duty, solid guys, and all they do is stare at the stage and the lighting and the sound, and watch everything and move the gear, and you don't talk to them. They just sit as a group, and they make sure everyone's safe, everything's runs perfectly, and everything is seamless, so that nobody even knows they're there. And they are amazing, so they're worth watching alone. And then of course the organizational skills. I don't know who's going to run that as far as like booking, like when people are when, but I guarantee you will be able to see the people you like, because there are shows nonstop and people play more than once.
Right.
And it's just like South by Southwest or something. You run into the room, you see a couple songs, you leave so someone else can come in, and then you
Right.
go and say, oh, I got to see half of this. You don't have to see the whole show,
Yeah.
but you'll want to. But I
I
don't
mean,
know. I just
you
love it.
can if you want, I mean, then you can make a determination to say, well, they're going to play it. So and so is going to play it this time, and they're playing against this band, but I'll go see them, tomorrow, this other time. Yeah, you can
And
work
also
that.
you got to eat and you got to sleep, and you get fatigued sometimes, and you need to just go back to your room and lay down for 15 minutes.
Take a power nap. Are you into power naps?
No, I don't sleep very good, unfortunately. I might.
Yeah. Well, so this today's the 5th of July. Yesterday was the 4th of July, and I wants to go out with the song, the X song, 4th of July, that Dave Alvin wrote when he was in the band briefly. I know he also plays with you guys in the Knitters. Is this true? I read somewhere that he taught you how to play guitar. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. Well, here's what happened. I was like learning guitar on my own because I was in a band with Billy Zoom and John. I'm not going to play guitar in that band. Those guys are like genius level rock and roll, players, and I can't play like that. And I was always intimidated, even though all the other kids were learning to play guitar. So one day I was on tour with Dave, and I said, "Hey, Dave, what's the difference between this and this, and how do you make a chord?" And he goes, "Well, this is a G, this is a D, this is an A, and this is an F." And I was like, "Oh, is that all there is to it?" He was like, "Yeah, that's it." And I was like, "Why didn't someone show me that before?" I don't know. We didn't have the internet. Thank God for Dave Elvin on so many levels. He's such a precious human.
Well, of course, he played in the Blasters, and you guys must have played a lot with the Blasters back early on in the day, or
Yes, we
not?
did. We did,
Okay.
and we went and saw them every chance we got. I'm sure that band is the band I've seen the most of any band in my life. But Dave Elvin's band, whether it's the Guilty Women, the Guilty Ones, or the Guilty Men, or whatever, is also an exceptional band, and he's exceptional. And I love seeing him play. So that's, he's been good for a long time.
Do you recall the first time you met him?
Yes. Absolutely recall the first time I walked into a big hall with John and saw the Blasters on stage, and it just almost died on the spot. I could not believe that they existed, because somebody playing those old songs like that back then, that was, who knew that that could happen? It was, yeah. And we got to meet them, and I just thought they were the greatest people. Still do.
And so he was in the band briefly for what was it, about a year, long enough to be part of the See How We Are album. And
Yeah, I mean, well, Billy didn't want to do it anymore, and I didn't want to do it anymore either, honestly, without Billy. But then I think John just kind of talked me into it. Like I said, he can talk anybody into anything. But then once we started doing it was fun, and I was also I got pregnant with my son. It was back when you could still smoke in clubs, and we got a tour with Tony, I guess, when he was in the band, opening for God, I can't remember his name. Anyway, in hall in big places, so that there was no smoking, and I could tour then. And so it was like I still had to work, I still had to work, and I toured up until my son was born. But then Dave wasn't touring with us. Tony was, Tony Gilkyson. But Dave was there briefly enough to kind of get us off the ground and get us started and go, okay, we can do this without Billy. It's okay. But then it became not okay. I didn't want to do it anymore. I didn't want to really do it without Billy, but you do the best you can.
And in the end, you had Billy back.
Well, yes, we did.
So, well, about the so we'll take a listen to 4th of July here in a moment. Do you have any recollection about the song, how Dave came up with it? Do you know?
I don't know. I love Dave's songs. I mean, he has so many great songs. He's just a songwriter. He's like a Merle Haggard guy. No, it was just proposed. Let's do this song. Okay, let's try it. Oh, it sounds great. Let's do this. It's not a big deal to write. Somebody brings in a song, you play it. Maybe you don't like it. Maybe you like it. You record it. Maybe you don't record it.
Yeah. All right, Maxine, thank you so much for speaking to me on our Coolest Conversations.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, look forward to seeing you on the big boat.
Yes, the big boat, the love boat, the love boat. I can't wait.
Yeah, that's great. The Love Boat. All right.
That's one of
Well,
my favorite shows, you know.
is it the
Yeah,
Love Boat?
Phyllis Diller was on it yesterday, which, it has
Oh.
all the great stars.
It does, yes. So you're watching that. Are you still surprised? Is there like an episode you hadn't seen before, and you go, "Oh my God, I can't believe they had so and so on there."
Yes, because I never watched it when it was on. It's terrible. But I
Oh,
do watch only old shows. So I watch The
yeah.
Love Boat and Beverly Hillbillies and Green Acres and Peter Gunn and Hawaii and I and stuff like that. 77 Sunset Strip. I just like having that stuff on in the living room. It's fun.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway,
So
it is
here's
The
fourth.
Love Boat. It'll be a great experience for everyone. And I hope, I don't know if there's tickets left, but if there is, get them. Because
That's
it's
right.
really going to
That's
be.
a good. I'm happy you pointed that out. It's like 75% sold out right now. So there's only 25% room left. So people need to get on that soon because it looks like it's going to sell out well before before the ship is sailing.
Well, I don't want to tell people what they must do, but I will say it will exceed your expectations. So if you're waffling about going or not, and you can afford it, you can budget for it if you need to. It is so worth doing. To me, it was it exceeded all my expectations of going on those cruises. And the music is amazing. The people are amazing. It's a love fest. It's wonderful.
Thanks, Sexy. Well, here's 4th of July from X off the album See How We Are in Little Steven's Underground Garage. X here in Little Steven's Underground Garage with a portion of their tune 4th of July. That's from their 1987 album called See How We Are. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to lead singer Exene Cervenka for joining me on today's Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. New York City band Joy Buzzer, they've got a new single out now on Wicked Cool Records titled You'd Be Surprised. And their guitarist Jet Becker will be my guest next time around to tell us all about it on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. On the stairs I smoke a cigarette alone.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.